Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, violence, suicide, sexual assault, rape, enslavement, and drug usage.
Before we begin today's episode, I have to correct the mistake I made during the last episode. I said Prince Kamran was blessed by the Sikh guru Arjan Dev, and this led to the guru's execution. The prince who was actually blessed was named Khusrau. Kamran was the son of Babur and brother of Humayun, not the son of Jahangir. Unfortunately, this error goes to show how important finding secondary and tertiary sources are in order to fully understand what happened throughout history, especially within an incredibly complex history like that of the Mughals. Scholars have made these same mistakes in their books, even after second and third editions. Regardless, I apologize for misleading or offending anyone. Nuruddin Jahangir ascended to the throne after the death of Akbar in 1605. He was many things: a patron of the arts, a loving father and grandfather, a heavy drinker, a sadist, and a casual opium user. Additionally, he was the first Mughal ruler who was born to a Rajput mother. For a vast majority of Akbar's long reign, he was stationed in Ajmer as the acting governor. When his rebellion was forgiven by Akbar and the royal turban was placed upon his head, Jahangir was able to ascend to the throne with relatively little opposition. Prior to the turban-placing ceremony, the royal court was split between Jahangir and his son Khusrau. Unlike Akbar, Jahangir made conciliatory gestures towards the orthodox Sunni clergy. Due to this, as well as other factors, Khusrau began a rebellion against his father in 1606. Unfortunately for him, this rebellion earned him Jahangir's animosity. Khusrau was easily defeated and imprisoned, leading to the execution of one of his supporters, the fifth guru of the Sikhs, Arjan Dev. During his imprisonment, Khusrau was blinded by the jailers. This was usually done with piping hot iron rods to ensure complete blindness. In Khusrau's case, he was only partially blinded. Either way, this punishment was excruciatingly painful and designed to disinherit the victim. As a precept to Sharia law is that all rulers need to have full use of their senses. Khusrau would remain under house arrest for most of his life, always within reach of Jahangir. Jahangir never forgave his child for his rebellion, and recounted the awkward encounters he had with the son he had blinded in his autobiography. Being blinded by Mughal authorities was only the tip of the iceberg when it came to punishments, which were doled out to quote-unquote disloyal subjects. A favorite torture which fascinated Jahangir was the tossing of the condemned to trained war elephants. In the last episode, we discussed how Akbar threw one man to the elephants for 5 days. Jahangir, meanwhile, took delight in watching the elephants rip apart human beings. Another favorite practice of the Mughals was cutting off the noses of criminals, leaving numerous people permanently disfigured. This was also done for any number of minor court infractions. For the worst offenders, a special punishment was used. Human beings were walled up alive with concrete. This was used on several Sikh rebels, including the children of one guru, during the reign of Aurangzeb. Khusrau's fate was sealed when he first started showing charisma and good leadership in his youth. Besides his father, his true nemesis turned out to be his own brother, Khurram, the future Padshah Shah Jahan. During one of his campaigns in the Deccan, he called on Khusrau to campaign with him. Hired killers were waiting for the partially blind prince, and upon his arrival to camp, he was murdered. In spite of all the violence, death, and bloodshed we've recounted thus far, this is the first instance of one brother killing another in cold blood within the royal house. Prior to this, brothers were arrested, blinded, and exiled, but never killed for ambition's sake or even as punishment. This violent streak would follow Khurram to the throne, where blood would flow like water at his request. Jahangir was a sickly man who suffered from bouts of severe asthma, which were only exacerbated by the climate of the subcontinent and his excessive drinking and drug usage. To counter these effects, Jahangir made it a point to have a yearly family vacation in Kashmir. Today, Kashmir is a disputed region on the borders of China, India, and Pakistan. It is one of the most militarized places in the entire world. In the early 17th century, Kashmir was a lush, temperate paradise made more beautiful by the building projects commissioned by the Mughals. Besides the lush gardens of Kashmir, Jahangir had one person in whom he truly confided. In time, she would become the de facto ruler of the country. Her name was Mir-un-Nisa, remembered by her title Nur Jahan, or the Light of the World. Nur Jahan was the daughter of a poor merchant. She was originally married to a Mughal officer, and it is likely around this time when Jahangir met her. Historians speculate that Nur Jahan's original husband either died in battle or was killed by Jahangir, freeing up Nur Jahan to become the newest wife of the Mughal emperor. She was already in her 30s and the two never had children together, but this did not stop her from becoming the most adored of all of Jahangir's wives. She took care of him when he was ill, undressed him when he was too drunk to move, and coddled him like a child when he was angry or frustrated. Jahangir was accustomed to this mothering from an early age. In his childhood, he was raised by the older women of Akbar's court. Ira Mukoti says Nur Jahan reminded Jahangir intensely of these quote-unquote mature women. Besides this, Nur Jahan was able to contend with Jahangir's ego and proved as capable as the emperor at hunting and marksmanship. Jahangir wrote glowingly of Nur Jahan and her ability to kill two animals in a single musket shot. Jahangir's dependency on opium and alcohol became so intense that all administrative duties soon fell into the hands of Nur Jahan. He wrote as much, saying, quote, "I have handed the business of government over to Nur Jahan. I require nothing beyond a sur, an Indian unit of measurement of wine, and half a sur of meat," unquote. It would be wrong to describe the relationship between Nur Jahan and Jahangir as love. It was a transactional relationship which ended up working out for both parties. Jahangir got to hunt, torture, and muse to his heart's content. Meanwhile, Nur Jahan acquired true financial independence for herself and her family. She was instrumental in the growing and trading of indigo. Indigo is one of the many crops grown in India which fascinated and enraptured the world. It was used primarily as a dye in rugs and textiles. Women were instrumental in this trade, as well as in the trade of other exports from India. In fact, Ira Mukoti asserts that almost half of all the names recorded in Mughal trade transactions belonged to women. The status of women in Mughal India was perplexing to their European counterparts. They simply could not understand how women were able to accrue so much wealth and act so independently. European women traveling to India were shocked at the level of equality between the sexes especially when it came to financial transactions. Unsurprisingly, Europeans considered this a perfect example of Mughal, quote-unquote, barbarism. Beyond this, they regarded with suspicion and contempt any women who remained unmarried and without children. In the worst example, quote-unquote, historians conclude that the only reason for this was because these women were having incestuous relationships with their fathers and brothers. In reality, Ira Mukoti puts forth that women remain single and without children because they could. Mughal women had their own wealth, their own means, and their own power. They didn't need to have a husband or live with their parents in order to be able to have a roof over their heads. Noor Jahan's case is obviously different. She achieved her power and influence because of her marriage to the Padshah, but this takes nothing away from her many accomplishments in the realm of trade and business. Additionally, numerous buildings throughout India were commissioned by Noor Jahan, and she was financially responsible for the housing and care of over 500 widows across the empire. This became a tradition of all-powerful Mughal women. She is also largely responsible for English predominance in foreign trade. She would come to call herself the protectress of the English. There was reasoning behind her decision. The Portuguese were becoming increasingly belligerent on the open ocean. In 1613, the Rahimi was seized, looted, and impounded, while its Mecca-bound passengers were imprisoned. Incidents like this occurred with regularity all across the Indian Ocean, but the seizure of the Rahimi was the straw which broke the camel's back. Jahangir declared cessation of all trade which occurred through the primary Mughal port of Surat. This emptied out the port city virtually overnight and bankrupted many Portuguese merchants who had made a killing off of shady mercantile transactions. Ira Mukoti says, quote, "The capture of the Rahimi and the insult it is perceived to be precipitates the decline of Portuguese fortunes. Already in 1612, an EIC, East India Company, fleet, under Captain Thomas Best, had decisively defeated a Portuguese armada off Surat," unquote. The gradual decline of the Portuguese Empire was a self-inflicted wound. They paved the way for their own destruction through hubris and zealous dogmas, something the Mughal Empire would do to itself as well. As the 1620s progressed, Noor Jahan was at the height of her power. She had the ability to use royal prerogatives in almost all situations. Besides her subtle administration of the realm, she is able to pass laws in her name and sign them with her own seal. Emblazoned on this seal are the words, quote, "By the light of the sun of the Emperor Jahangir, the bezel of the seal of Noor Jahan, the Empress of the Age, has become resplendent, like the moon," unquote. Most amazingly, she has coins minted in her own name, which are used throughout the empire. During this whole time, Jahangir pursued his own fancies, which included fashion, patronizing the arts, and expanding the realm through conquest. The opulence of Mughal India was nearing its peak. To illustrate the point, Jahangir never wore the same outfit twice. These outfits were always bejeweled with diamonds, rubies, pearls, and emeralds, and meticulously handcrafted by some of the greatest artisans of the age. Jahangir was a fashion trailblazer in some respects. He was the first Mughal leader to wear earrings. He did this to show his devotion to a Sufi mystic of great renown, but it became fashionable for men all across the subcontinent to wear earrings soon after the emperor donned them. In the arts, he sought to introduce European design and aesthetics to Mughal India. He loved European paintings and often commissioned his Mughal artists to create exact replicas of them. Next, he would invite European diplomats to attempt to correctly pick which of the two paintings was the replica. More often than not, they had trouble deciding. These frivolous pursuits were nothing compared to Jahangir's true loves, drinking wine and smoking opium. He wrote openly about his addiction, saying he drank as many as, quote, 20 cups of wine a day, unquote. 16 of these cups would be consumed before the sun went down. Other drugs he used included caffeine and tobacco, which had been introduced to the subcontinent by European traders. Opium, however, was his favorite by far. The poppies grown for opium production were readily available all across northern India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. In fact, Kashmir grew vast amounts of poppy. Opium has always been a part of the Mughal Empire. Humayun used the excuse, quote, "I am an opium eater," unquote, when confronted by his wives for not visiting them enough. And Babur frequently consumed trace amounts of opium when indulging in majun. Cannabis was also readily available across India. It grew especially well around the Hindu Kush Mountains. The popular modern-day strain of cannabis, called Kush, is named for these mountains. There are no reports of Mughal royalty smoking cannabis, which they called bhang. It was mostly used, as it is now, by common people, and especially by dervishes, who smoked copious amounts in order to experience a religious awakening. Militarily, the rulers of Mewar were always bristling for autonomy. The new Maharana waged a number of rebellions against Jahangir, but always came up short against the much superior Mughal army. In reality, the rulers of Mewar stood little chance against the Mughals, especially since they refused to turn the conflict into a larger pan-Hindu or pan-Indian movement, which would be focused on the liberation of the entire subcontinent. Regardless, the warriors and leaders of Mewar showed repeatedly that they would not be cowed and made to suffer through Mughal overlordship without a fight. The main focus of Jahangir's military campaigns was to subjugate the rest of the southern end of India. This rugged land, referred to as the Deccan Plateau, was a near impossible place to invade. Since the 1100s, Muslim armies had tried and failed to conquer this harsh land, succeeding only once. The biggest thorn in the side of Mughal conquest ended up being the stronghold of Ahmadnagar, defended by one of the great figures in history. Born Chipu in the highlands of Ethiopia, Malik Ambar was sold into slavery by his own parents. He traveled the width of most of the Muslim world, being sold once more to a fellow Ethiopian while in Baghdad. His new enslaver took Malik Ambar under his wing and more or less adopted the boy as his own son. Enslavement in India was much different in many respects to the enslavement or human trafficking practiced throughout the Middle East, Europe, and the Americas. In India, enslaved people were usually employed as house servants, and avenues existed for enslaved people, like Ambar's enslaver who had previously been enslaved, to gain their freedom and become independently wealthy. Ethiopians made up a large portion of the population in the Indian subcontinent, especially in the south, where many Ethiopians worked as mercenary warriors. Ambar found a niche in this role and quickly realized he was a natural leader of men. In time, his enslaver passed away, freeing Ambar, but Ambar decided to stick with the military. He gained a huge following and became so powerful that he was able to become de facto leader of Ahmadnagar. He placed the puppet on the throne, married his own daughter to the puppet, and had himself named prime minister. Ambar was intent on keeping his power. He waged ceaseless war against the Mughals, who were attempting to annex Ahmadnagar as it would provide them a stepping stone into the rest of the Deccan region. For decades, Malik Ambar waged a highly successful guerrilla campaign against the Mughal armies sent against him. he frustrated and infuriated Jahangir so thoroughly that the Mughal emperor commissioned a painting of himself bestriding the world and shooting an arrow into Malik Ambar's severed head. One of the main reasons Ambar was able to succeed against the Mughals was his employment of southern Indian cavalry known as the Maratha. They were led by Shihaji, the head of the Bhonsle dynasty. He used hit-and-run tactics, which were highly successful. His young son, Shivaji, would learn valuable lessons from both Ambar and his father. Jahangir's health was declining with each passing year. Factions began to coalesce around his surviving princes. Amongst the leading candidates were Prince Khurram, Prince Shahryar, and Prince Parvez, who each had their own substantial connections with the Mughal court. In 1622, the usually warm relations between the Mughals and the Persian Empire grew exceedingly cold. Persian armies swept through Kandahar and rapidly overwhelmed the city's meager garrison. This effectively severed the Mughal Empire from their original Central Asian homeland. The loss of this area set off the slow decline in trained horse archers and archers in general, which the Mughal Empire would experience over the coming years. Prior to this, skilled bowmen complemented musketeers, usually covering them as they reloaded. The loss of these trained archers brought down the overall versatility of the Mughal Empire in a substantial way. It turned the loose formations of infantry into more or less useless formations of undisciplined men, not coordinated enough to launch an invigorated assault, and not disciplined enough to resist one. It did not help that the pay for Mughal armies was always in arrears. Historians claim that some armies were not paid for upwards of 5 years. Colonel Anil Thali says this turned warfare in India into, quote, highly ritualized events, unquote. Because of this, military strategies like total war fell by the wayside. Warfare was now about drawn-out sieges, bribes, and hastily drawn-up treaties. Andrew de la Garza further contends that India did not have the proper kilns and metallurgy equipment which was needed in order to create state-of-the-art cast-iron siege artillery. In this era, and the one following it, he claims the Mughal army began to seriously fall off, especially when compared to European armies in countries like France, Spain, and England, who constantly fought with one another. The same year Persia invaded Mughal Central Asia, Khurram started a rebellion attempting to supplant his brothers and his ailing father. Ultimately, he was defeated and was reviled by Jahangir for his act. In 1626, the half-alive Padsha was captured by a rebellious vassal who declared his support for Prince Parvez. Through guile and diplomacy, Nur Jahan had the emperor freed and had the rebellious subject chased out of Mughal India, where he soon died. In 1627, Jahangir passed away, paving the way for Khurram to become the fifth Padsha of the Mughal Empire. Upon ascension, he assumed the name Shah Jahan, or King of the World. He set about erasing the memory of Nur Jahan, making it punishable by death to use coinage which bore her seal. He melted down any metal bearing her name and had her exiled to the far corners of the empire, where she was rendered completely powerless. Shah Jahan's first act was to go on a familial murder spree. Brothers, cousins, and nephews all fell in the face of this bloody purge. Anyone who had shown him disloyalty, or anyone who had a meager claim to the throne, was executed. Before her exile and her husband's death, Nur Jahan managed to marry her relative, Arjumand Banu, to Prince Khurram. Upon the prince's ascension, Arjumand Banu became the new Padsha Begum and was given the name Mumtaz Mahal, or the Elect of the Palace. In the end, Jahangir is described by Anne-Marie Schimmel as, quote, an extraordinarily complex character. As punishment for a slight misdemeanor or oversight, he was capable of shooting a man on the spot or having him flayed. Yet he was so distraught at the death of a granddaughter that he was unable to write about the event, unquote. Jahangir, in many ways, began the slow decline of the Mughal Empire. His administration, or lack thereof, was a serious detriment to the overall effectiveness of the state. He added nothing of note, neither by conquest, reform, nor leadership. His petulance, childishness, and cruelty were a perfect cocktail for an absent-minded and arbitrary leader. Shah Jahan had spent the past few decades waging constant wars in the Deccan. This experience undoubtedly hardened him and gave him a serious edge in his bid for power. When he was declared Padsha, he was almost constantly at war. These were usually wars against vassals and rebellious subjects, but there were also wars of conquest. One of the most notable of these wars was the invasion of Hooghly, controlled by the Portuguese. Mughal armies swept aside the Portuguese. Their factories in the region were leveled, and many of the prisoners were tortured to death. The rest were brought in chains to Delhi and sold into slavery. Dr. Suresh Rai K. claims that thousands of Portuguese soldiers were killed during the fight. Unlike other Padshahs, Shah Jahan had no addictions to drugs or alcohol. In one instance, Jahangir had to force him to drink wine at a celebration. He also had very few wives, only three. Comparatively, we still don't know exactly how many wives, mistresses, and concubines Akbar had. Shah Jahan was an altogether different person from his predecessors. He was absolutely in love with his wife, Mumtaz Mahal. Over the course of 19 years together, they had 14 children. Of the six who survived to adulthood, four would play an incredibly important role in Indian history moving forward. Unfortunately, we know very little about Mumtaz Mahal. All we have is the overly censored Mughal court history of the harem, which was not completely accurate, as they claimed women, regardless of age, relationship status, or number of children, were quote-unquote chaste and quote-unquote virgin-like. However, modern historians who have studied these court documents, as well as primary sources, believe that Mumtaz Mahal and Shah Jahan were devoted to each other to an extent which hadn't yet been seen in the Mughal court and wouldn't be seen again after. In 1631, Mumtaz Mahal was giving birth to her 14th child. The labor lasted for hours, and it soon became clear that the light of the palace would not survive this ordeal. She died in labor, and Shah Jahan was supposedly beside himself with grief. It is said that he, quote, shed tears like rain, unquote, and that overnight, quote, his hair became gray, unquote. In honor of his wife and his eternal love for her, he purchased the plot of land and had the Taj Mahal constructed as his wife's final burial place. There were many inspirations for the designs of the Taj Mahal. In fact, Nur Jahan had commissioned several projects before this time which bore similar resemblance to the designs which were grafted onto the Taj Mahal. Besides the use of Timurid-style pomegranate architecture, Indian construction workers introduced marble to the building designs. The tomb is a stunning monument to love. It's estimated that it cost a good part of the Mughal treasury. Shah Jahan ultimately never visited the Taj Mahal. There are several theories as to why. Ibn Makoti contends it was because he knew he would stay there eternally if he ever went. Upon his death, Shah Jahan was buried next to the wife to whom he doted and for whom he sacrificed so much of the state treasury. Jahanara Begum was the child of Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal. She is easily one of the most influential Mughal women in history. She was an avid merchant, philosopher, mystic, philanthropist, businesswoman, and loving daughter and sister. Upon the death of her mother, she was named the newest Padshah Begum and would come to play an integral role in the looming succession crisis. She threw her support behind her brother, Dadashuko. He was a Sufi mystic and an acclaimed artist who very much embraced Indian culture. He wished more than anything to find common ground between Hindus and Muslims. Aurangzeb was the couple's third surviving son. He was a Sunni fundamentalist and was often described as quote-unquote guarded and calculating. He was the governor of the Deccan and was much loved by his grandfather Jahangir. In a famous instance, it is said that Aurangzeb faced down a rampaging elephant with only a sword to defend himself. He was admonished by Shah Jahan for being too reckless, but Aurangzeb said that the only unworthy ones were his brothers, who stood by and did nothing. Throughout the 1630s, 1640s, and 1650s, Mughal armies marched against numerous enemies. With the death of Malik Ambar, Ahmadnagar fell easily to the Mughals in 1633. In 1636, Golconda submitted to Mughal overlordship, but Mughal armies had to return in 1655. A similar instance occurred in Bijapur. The people there rose up two separate times in the 1630s and the 1650s. Finally, Shah Jahan attempted to conquer Central Asia for the Mughals once more. Besides the great distances this campaign entailed, the supply situation was always tenuous. In spite of this, Aurangzeb proved his talent as a commander and conquered Kandahar and Balkh. The army was attacked on their way home, and over 5,000 Mughals were killed by Afghan tribesmen. These cities would not remain a part of the Mughal Empire for long. Besides the incredibly costly Taj Mahal, Shah Jahan resolved to construct an entirely new capital city on the outskirts of Delhi. Named Shah Jahanabad, this new city would be the new home of the Mughal court. This move was made in order to get away from the increasing squalor and urbanization of downtown Delhi. Next, he ordered the construction of a grand throne. Remembered as the Peacock Throne, it cost over 8.5 million rupees, making it the most expensive throne ever constructed. The Mughals possessed numerous gemstones of magnificent quality and size. Amongst them was the Koh-i-Noor, a massive, supposedly cursed diamond, which today is a part of the British crown jewels. Contrary to modern-day speculation, the Mughals held ballast rubies and spinels in a higher regard than diamonds. Upon these rubies and spinels, they engraved Arabic verses from the Quran. Everything from cups to silverware to books were inlaid and covered with gold, jade, and rubies, often using floral designs inspired by Indian wildlife. In the face of these riches, the common people lived in mud huts thatched together with dry leaves. These caught fire easily, and other unsanitary conditions spread famine and disease throughout the Indian subcontinent during the reign of the Mughals. When the people suffered, Shah Jahan usually looked the other way, even redirecting wheat and food to the construction workers of the Taj Mahal as opposed to his suffering subjects. In many respects, Shah Jahan styled himself as a second Timur, going as far as to have stargazers call him the second lord of the fortunate conjunction. He emulated his great ancestor with his military conquests as well. His decision to invade Central Asia, for example, was based purely on the region's history as the Timurid homeland. Mughal emperors since the time of Babur had attempted to emulate Timur in some fashion, and this did not end with Shah Jahan. Jahanara Begum was a devout Sufi who wrote two separate books about her journey through Sufi mysticism. One of these books is the only autobiography written by a woman during the 17th century. Her Sufi mentor would have accepted her as his peer, but her gender supposedly excluded her from advancing. She refused to let this stop her, and she took it upon herself to fund many mosques dedicated to Sufi saints. She built these all across northern India. Once she wrote, quote, "I was in a peculiar state, which was neither sleep nor wakefulness, and it completely overpowered me. I saw the majlis of the holy prophet Muhammad, where the four friends, noble companions, and great saints were present. Mullah Shah, her mentor, was amongst the latter, and had placed his head at the feet of the holy prophet, who graciously remarked, 'Why have you illuminated the Timurid lamp?'" Unquote. The one who introduced Jahanara to Sufism was her brother Darashuko. She describes her brother as her soulmate, someone who shares her beliefs and worldview. Darashuko was eternally restless. He searched for the meaning of things and the overriding truth which he believed existed in all religions and cultures. Mystics, self-proclaimed healers, and warlocks followed Dada wherever he went. He was fabulously wealthy, so he was able to dispense plenty of rupees to his followers. He had one great rival at court, and this was the ultra-orthodox Sunni clergy. Darashuko detested these men. He once said, quote, "In the city where a mullah, an Islamic theologian, resides, no wise man is ever found," unquote. His beliefs in mysticism never reached the same level of his beloved sister, Jahanara. Irimikoti called his intellectual pursuits, quote-unquote, scattershot, and they were increasingly aimed toward the most obscure. This became so bad that he was supposedly prepared to take a potion which consisted of the sacrifice of, quote, "two dancing girls, two thieves, two gamblers, a dog, a sheep, a buffalo, and five chickens," unquote. As Shah Jahan's court became more conservative and influenced by the clergy, Darashuko became increasingly isolated. It did not help that contemporaries described him as someone who, quote, "entertained too exalted an opinion of himself, believed he could accomplish everything by the powers of his own mind, and imagined that there existed no man from whose counsel he could derive benefit," unquote. Equally isolated from the court at Shah Jahanabad, but much more calculating, Aurangzeb grew his legacy through military victories and results. The 1640s and early 1650s were unprecedented times of peace for the Mughal Empire. This was arguably the high watermark for the Mughals in terms of economic power and worldwide renown. It is fair to say that the Mughals were probably the most powerful dynasty in the world, rivaling Habsburg Spain, the Ottoman Empire, and England. One truly cataclysmic event occurred in 1644. Jahanara was preparing the royal palace for a special occasion. This was one of her many duties as Padsha Begum. In her frantic haste, her dress, which had been doused in fine perfumes, caught fire when it brushed against one of the many candles along the floor. Two servant girls died trying to extinguish the flames, and Jahanara was severely burned. It took months for her to recover, and Shah Jahan was so inconsolable that he neglected the duties of state and stayed for hours with his daughter, even carefully washing her burned skin. Eventually, she recovered, but she remained scarred her entire life. Throughout his daughter's recovery, Shah Jahan was not taking part in the daily royal proceedings. Before this catastrophe, the Padsha greeted his subjects and heard their pleas for redress every morning. Every special occasion, the Padsha was weighed, and gold equaling the emperor's weight was distributed to the poor and needy. These are both Hindu rituals to which the Mughals adhered. This maintained a sense of continuity with the peasantry, who were as oppressed as ever, so the faith of their ruler oppressing them made little difference. It helped that Hindus played an integral role in all levels of the Mughal state. Without Hindu soldiers, merchants, craftsmen and leaders, Mughal India would have collapsed in the blink of an eye. This whole time, Aurangzeb brooded about his brother's quote-unquote heresies and his father's disdain for him as a son and a leader. Dadashuko, meanwhile, was saying increasingly radical things. He said, quote, "Hands soiled with gold begin to stink. How bad would be the plight of a soul soiled with gold?" Unquote. Next, he was convinced that the ancient Hindu text, the Vedas and the Upanishads, speak of a, quote, "hidden truth," unquote, which in Sufism is supposed to exist in all religions. Aurangzeb was always cold and calculating, but the hate he had for Dadashuko went beyond animosity. It's fair to say that the two were the exact antithesis of one another. Dada represented a return to the principles of Akbar, who ruled his nation through understanding and philosophy. Aurangzeb represented the conservative, quote-unquote, pious clergy. In the mid-1640s, the relationship between Shah Jahan and Aurangzeb reached a new low, when the latter was stripped of his governorship and many of his titles. For a time, Aurangzeb traveled as a vagabond, even contemplating foregoing his claim to the throne altogether. He writes to Jahanara, quote, "If His Majesty wishes that of all His servants, I alone should pass my life in dishonor and at last perish in an unbecoming manner, I have no help but to obey. It is better that by order of His Majesty, I should be released from the shame of such a life, so that harm may not be done to the good of the state and other hearts may be composed about this matter." Unquote. It took the entreaties of Jahanara to repeal her father's decision, and Aurangzeb was reinstated as governor of the Deccan and restored his lost titles. Amongst his immediate family, Aurangzeb had one stalwart supporter, his sister, Rashanara Begum. She had a clear little sibling complex and wished more than anything to be on the same pedestal as perfect Jahanara. In order to achieve her ends, she set about relaying confidential information about Dadashuko and the state of politics at the royal court to Aurangzeb. This greatly aided Aurangzeb in discovering that Dada had been alienated by much of the nobility, and the rest of the nobility supported a more fundamentalist regime. Aurangzeb would come to use this information to his own benefit and to the detriment of his people. In 1655, Dadashuko was the clear heir apparent, beloved by his father to such an extent that he was not allowed to go on military campaigns, lest he be gone too long. That same year, Dada released his literary magnum opus, called the Majma ul Bahrain, or The Mingling of the Two Oceans. Irin Makoti says this book endeavors to, quote, "establish the similarities between Sufi and Hindu thought. This is less an attempt to fuse the two religious thoughts than to find Hindu support for Sufi doctrine," unquote. In it, Dada accepts all religions as valid and asserts that they all support similar principles and doctrines. This progressive work would come to influence scholars like Arthur Schopenhauer and poets like William Blake. In 1657, the relative peace which had existed for almost two decades came to an abrupt end. Shah Jahan fell seriously ill. Supposedly, he was unable to urinate for 3 days, causing many nobles to fear his end was near. The separate factions of the court set about siding with their favorite sons. The coming secession crisis would be the most violent and bloody of all the secession crises which had preceded it. Dada was still the clear favorite in spite of the many, quote-unquote, heretical beliefs that he held. So Aurangzeb allied himself with his brother, Murad, and promised to split the empire between the two following their victory. This was a lie. Besides growing civil unrest amongst the royal family, the Mughal Empire was already showing signs of serious decay. years of peace had allowed the royal coffers to grow considerably. But new rebellions, ostentatious building projects, and wanton corruption caused the economy to collapse. Famine struck nearly the entire subcontinent, paving the way for more violence and anarchy in the countryside, which was loosely patrolled by poorly equipped Mughal infantry and cavalry squads. In May of 1657, Aurangzeb and his brother's armies had captured Agra and had imprisoned Jahanara as well as Shah Jahan. Later that same month, Aurangzeb delivered a crushing defeat to Dara Shikoh and his imperial army. In another engagement, Dara Shikoh's army was annihilated, and he was forced to flee for his life. Attempting to escape the country, he was betrayed and brought in chains to Delhi. Aurangzeb had a special punishment in mind for his older brother, whom he loathed so much. He stripped Dara of all his finery and gave him a filthy rag to wear. Next, Aurangzeb had his older brother paraded throughout the city on a decrepit, emaciated elephant. Instead of being met with derision and laughter by the crowd, the people showed intense respect and adoration for their favorite prince. This is not what Aurangzeb had intended, and he quickly canceled the rest of the public humiliations. 2 years later, Dara was brought before Aurangzeb, where his son was killed in front of him. Then he was executed for being a quote-unquote heretic. Notably, the same year Dara was executed, Aurangzeb officially ascended to the peacock throne as emperor, assuming the title Aurangzeb Alamgir Kuld Makan, or He Who Resides in Eternal Paradise. Shah Jahan recovered from his ailments and spent the next 8 years in confinement at his palace. Alongside him was Jahanara, who stood loyally beside her ailing father. Famously, his prison was in view of his wife's final resting place. Aurangzeb never attempted to reconcile with his father once he had seized power. A son usurping a father was a serious sin in the Islamic faith. This garnered him a negative reputation amongst other Muslim leaders. The Persian Shah quipped that Aurangzeb didn't, quote, conquer the world, unquote. Instead, he, quote, conquered his father, unquote. Aurangzeb only allowed his father one meal for the rest of his life. Shah Jahan was advised that he should choose dal, an Indian soup, as his only meal, since it was able to be prepared differently each serving. Shah Jahan would finally pass away in 1666 and was buried next to his beloved in the Taj Mahal. Jahanara hoped she would be allowed to hold a grand state funeral for Shah Jahan, but Aurangzeb forbade any such display. When the British arrived and took over, they hosted parties in the Taj Mahal and danced in the same room where a husband and wife were solemnly laid to rest. Much like his father, Aurangzeb did not suffer from any addictions. He was, above all else, a fundamentalist who had the enthusiastic support of the Sunni Muslim clergy. He did not patronize the arts, and he was not a great builder. He endeavored to reign through Sharia law, and if one were to judge his reign based on this alone, he succeeded entirely. In his free time, he copied the Quran and never engaged in ostentatious parties. Many historians say he banned alcohol outright throughout the realm. However, I have read contradictory information regarding this point. It seems he banned himself from consuming alcohol, while much of the court still partook. Regardless, this alienated him with the largely alcoholic nobility. Additionally, Aurangzeb banned music and dance from being performed in his presence, considering it quote-unquote unholy. Finally, he began the steady process of doing away with Hindu traditions at court. This included the daily meeting between him and his vassals, as well as the popular weighing ceremony. Dr. Suresh Rai K. says, quote, Aurangzeb's reign can be divided into two almost equal portions. The first 23 years were largely a continuation of Shah Jahan's administration, unquote. The second half of his reign was defined by religious bigotry and persecution, which alienated millions of his own subjects. During the second half, he forbade the construction of new Hindu and Sikh temples, while mandating several rebellious religious minorities should have their temples torn down and burned. It was in stark contrast to the beloved Darashuko's policy of religious tolerance, as well as Akbar's quest for religious enlightenment. One of the most hated acts was Aurangzeb's reinstitution of the jizya tax against non-Muslims. He also allowed for an increase in power for the regional governors, or mansabdars. Previously, Mughal padshahs would rotate these mansabdars, not allowing them to build loyal power bases. This system had obvious drawbacks, but on the whole, it proved effective at relegating the power of the mansabdars. With Aurangzeb endlessly campaigning in the Deccan, a power vacuum opened in the northern half of the country. This created a new aristocracy, which was entirely corrupt and had regional loyalties, allowing for several independent kingdoms to form under the most powerful Mughal vassals. Aurangzeb's religious policies were clearly detrimental to the stability of his empire. It was bad enough that he alienated many minority religions on the subcontinent, but when he began angering Hindus across the empire, it proved to be the first nail in the coffin of the Mughal dynasty. Because of this alienation and instability, Aurangzeb was constantly on the warpath against his own vassals. In Afghanistan, he suffered reverses at the hands of tribesmen who had declared a holy war against the Mughals. It took Aurangzeb's personal leadership to finish off the rebellion for good, but it forever disrupted the already tense relationship which existed between the Afghani people and the Mughals. Although Aurangzeb had a lust for military conquest, he was also convinced that it was his job to turn India into a, quote, Dar-ul-Islam, unquote, or a realm of Islam. Throughout the 1660s, he passed vindictive and arbitrary laws which targeted Hindus specifically. For example, in 1665, custom duties were imposed on Hindus at twice the rate they were imposed on Muslims. In 1667, Aurangzeb abolished this tax for Muslims altogether, while Hindus were stuck paying the original rate. He forbade Hindu holidays and festivals, and refused Hindu people positions in government. This was a complete 180 from the prior policy, which put forth a meritocracy. Hindus turned against the Mughal state in a large way. Several regional Hindu rebellions occurred because of this racist and bigoted policy. Aurangzeb was not satisfied with just pissing off most of his subjects, so he began antagonizing the increasingly militant Sikhs. They began making common cause with their Hindu neighbors, and in many disputes, the Sikhs sided with Hindus against the Mughal state. The ninth guru of the Sikhs was Tej Bahadur. He was largely responsible for turning Anandpur into a center for Sikhism. The emperor demanded that Tej Bahadur begin demolishing his own Sikh temples in exchange for Muslim mosques. The guru flat out refused to do so, and he was called to court to answer for this quote-unquote crime. Before he could arrive, he was arrested outside the gates of Delhi. He and his entourage were brought before the emperor, who demanded that the guru convert to Sunniism. The guru refused, and every member of his entourage was beheaded in front of him until he was beheaded as well. The tenth guru, Govinda Singh, would declare the struggle against the Mughals a holy conflict and introduce several crucial aspects of Sikhism to the new religion. He introduced these precepts at a lavish ceremony. He called on several volunteers who were willing to sacrifice their own lives. Seven would-be victims stepped forward, and instead of killing them, he claimed that they were born anew as his new children, and these men became the Seven Singhs. Besides this introduction of a new underclass of subordinates loyal to the guru, Govinda also introduced the 5 Ks of Sikhism. The 5 Ks are objects Sikhs must have in their possession at all times. These are kesh, which is uncut hair and a beard, kada, a steel bracelet, kanga, a wooden comb, the kacha, cotton underwear, and finally, the kirpan, a steel sword or dagger. From his base in the northwest of the Punjab region, the 10th Guru waged several military campaigns against the Mughals. During these wars, two of his sons would die in combat. Another two were captured and walled up alive before being set aflame. Following a particularly successful campaign against the Mughals, the Guru signed a favorable peace deal and looked toward the future. However, before he could increase his growing flock, an assassin, who some argue was in the pay of Aurangzeb, killed the Guru whilst at camp in 1707. The reins of the militant Sikhism would pass into the hands of Banda Bairagi, who would forge a path of destruction and conquest to the very gates of Delhi, until he was finally stopped. Aurangzeb shifted his focus to destabilizing the Rajputs. Besides his endless war in the Deccan, this proved to be the most disastrous of his policies. He destroyed Hindu temples throughout the Rajasthan and sent numerous expeditions against the leaders of the area. This helped further destabilize the Mughal state, which greatly relied upon the assistance and manpower the Rajputs provided. Upon the death of the Rajput leader, his wives were, quote-unquote, redirected to Aurangzeb's harem. Aurangzeb intended on turning the young Rajput prince into a devout Muslim and raising him as his own son. His plan was foiled when the boy, alongside the Rajput women, were rescued in a daring escape attempt. Rajput clans began joining the rebellion. Mewar, a city which had perennially rebelled against the Mughals, joined on the side of the rebels as well. However, the combination of Mughal might and Aurangzeb's leadership was too great for the Rajputs. Once more, they took to the hills, and once more they waged a highly successful guerrilla campaign against the Mughals. The Mughals stormed the great cities of Rajasthan and burned hundreds of Hindu temples to the ground. In their place, they erected mosques. Besides destroying the once sacrosanct relationship between the Rajputs and the Mughals, the Rajput rebellion cleaved the Mughal court into factions. The more quote-unquote liberal faction was headed by Aurangzeb's son, Muhammad Akbar. He supported the Rajput rebellion and eventually joined it. He promised to bring back the tolerant religious policies of his namesake, Akbar the Great. In order to maintain his power, Aurangzeb devised a clever ruse to use against his son. He dispatched a letter to Muhammad Akbar, congratulating him for fooling the Rajputs. The Rajputs discovered this letter, which was filled with lies, and they began to suspect that they were being betrayed by Muhammad Akbar. The prince had lost all his allies in a matter of weeks. He fled to the Deccan, where he was pursued mercilessly by his vengeful father. Finally, he found refuge in Persia, where he died in 1704. Having dealt with his enemies in the north and west, Aurangzeb turned south, where he was determined to conquer the Deccan Plateau and silence the Maratha and the Deccani sultans once and for all. He pursued his imperial ambitions under the guise of religious intent. The Deccan was home to many Shia Muslims, and it was also rich in certain resources. Additionally, by controlling the Deccan, Aurangzeb would also control a virtual monopoly on all trade flowing out of India. He conquered Bijapur first before moving on to the kingdom of Golconda, where he captured the city of Hyderabad in 1685. The kingdom's namesake city, Golconda, was placed under siege, but Mughal forces were continually beset by disease and famine in the countryside. In the end, Dr. Suresh Rai K. says the Mughals resorted to treachery. They bribed a man inside Golconda to open the gates, and in a fierce hand-to-hand struggle, the Mughals overcame the garrison. This ended all hopes of Shia autonomy in the southern half of the Indian subcontinent. Neighboring the kingdom of Golconda were the Marathas. They were led by an ambitious, calculating, and revolutionary leader named Shivaji, often referred to as the Great. He was born during the rule of Shah Jahan, and it was during this time that Colonel Anil Athal says, quote, "Shivaji took an oath to establish Hindavi Swarajya, or Indian self-rule," unquote. This idea was espoused over 100 years prior to the founding of the United States, while the philosopher John Locke was still only an adolescent. Shivaji, however, did not believe in a dominating form of Hinduism. He realized that India was a vast melting pot of various religions and cultures. For this reason, he made a point to never ostracize or oppress the many Muslims who called the Maratha state home. His Muslim citizens rewarded his progressive religious beliefs with loyalty. The Maratha artillery, for example, was manned exclusively by Muslims who lived in the Maratha domain. Thanks to the help of these Muslim artillerists, Maratha artillery became famous on the subcontinent, but it still had the same defects which plagued all large cast-iron weapons forged in India. Indian forges simply weren't able to get hot enough to cast the massive pieces of artillery which were needed in sieges. To counter, they smithed each piece of the cannon individually. This had obvious drawbacks. A single misfire or problem with the assembly could have devastating consequences. Shivaji's revolution also introduced a military revolution to the subcontinent. The ritualized nature of warfare in India turned armies into giant masses of men with little real fighting experience. Shivaji endeavored to reintroduce total war to the area. He would burn bridges, set fields of grain on fire, and pursue his enemy mercilessly until they were entirely destroyed. Shivaji utilized hit-and-run tactics with an army which was almost exclusively made up of cavalry. From his native base in Maharashtra, he grew his influence, army, and political power at the expense of his neighbors. Besides his military genius, Shivaji was a charismatic diplomat who was able to flatter and cajole almost anyone into supporting him. His army was bolstered by over 400 forts, which could easily be reinforced and evacuated if the situation called for it. This impressive offensive-defensive approach to war complemented the national state he was trying to build. In order to illustrate the sort of man that Shivaji was, in 1699, his small army was staring down a much larger army belonging to one of the Deccani Sultanates. He feigned weakness to his enemy, saying he was cowering from atop the mountain in fear of his life. He begged the enemy to meet with him so they could discuss peace. Arriving at the so-called peace conference, Shivaji pulled out a concealed tiger claw, or Bagh Nakh, and used the weapon to open up the stomach of the enemy commander. As the enemy leader lay bleeding out, he gave his concealed army the order to fall upon the unready enemy, killing thousands and routing the rest. Next, he raided Mughal territory, shifted his power base to the south in the case of a determined Mughal invasion, and began building a modern navy which could protect the vast coastline of the subcontinent if called upon. Up to this point, there were few native Indian states who invested in their navies. Those that did, like in Bengal, gained reputations as ferocious pirates. These quote-unquote pirates caused constant headaches for the Mughals, but instead of investing in a navy themselves, they kept their activities focused on the land. The failure of the Mughals to grow a substantial navy was obviously a key factor in their eventual collapse. Likewise, the Marathas' resolve to be a seafaring peoples signaled their ascent to the world stage. After agreeing to a hasty peace with the Mughals, Shivaji now allied with them. However, upon arriving in court, he was placed amongst the lesser nobility. This infuriated the prideful man, and Shivaji said many uncouth things in front of Aurangzeb. Due to these infractions, Shivaji was made a prisoner at the Mughal court. Aurangzeb and other nobility were planning to assassinate Shivaji, but Shivaji proved once again to be a special character. He feigned serious illness and pretended to be dreadfully sick. This way, Mughal guards would not trail him as closely. Next, he began sending alms and donations to gurus and holy men throughout northern India in the hopes that these donations would help him get better. In reality, he was lulling his captors into a false sense of security. Eventually, they stopped checking these donation baskets, and Shivaji, alongside his son, used this opportunity to escape inside of one. It was not until 1674, after he had ruled for nearly 3 decades, that Shivaji ascended the throne as an independent ruler. Shivaji was now considered the head of the Hindu military caste, Lord of the Throne, Maharaja, and Chachapati. Upon his ascension, he introduced 8 ministers to assist him in ruling the realm. Shivaji's system was designed for efficiency. These 8 ministers held positions which were thoroughly modern. There was a prime minister, for example, as well as a minister of finance, a home minister, and a foreign minister. Unfortunately, Shivaji would only have 6 years left to live. In that time, he threatened British positions in Bengal and alienated his son to such an extent that he abandoned the Maratha court in favor of working with the Mughals. How Shivaji died remains a complete mystery. Either he had a severe illness, or he was poisoned by any number of rivals. His estranged first son, Sambhaji, is described as, quote, a brave but temperamental person, unquote. At the time of Shivaji's death, he was under Mughal house arrest. Aurangzeb wanted to use the death of his rival to conquer the rest of the subcontinent, so he launched the Mughal army in a total invasion of the Maratha territory. The political power of the Marathas coalesced around Shivaji's widow, Soyrabai, who conspired to place her own son, Rajaram, on the throne. Unfortunately for her, Rajaram only ruled for several months before Sambhaji pulled off a daring escape from Mughal captivity. Since Sambhaji was the firstborn male, he ascended to the throne in July of 1680. He wasted no time in punishing his political opponents, proving he had as vicious a streak as his father. He imprisoned his brother and his brother's wife, and he had Soyrabai executed on charges of conspiracy. His military efforts were primarily directed against the Portuguese, who were attempting to hold on to their meager power in India. The Mughals were busy invading the Deccani Sultans. In 1682, the Mughals turned their attention to the Marathas. In 1687, Mughal armies severely mauled the Marathas at the Battle of Wai. Maratha soldiers began deserting Sambhaji en masse, and the newly formed Maratha kingdom was on the precipice of completely falling apart. In 1689, Sambhaji was captured by the Mughals and brought before Aurangzeb to answer for his crimes. He was ordered by the emperor to convert to Islam or be tortured to death. Sambhaji remained defiant until the end. He said he wouldn't convert, quote, not even if the emperor bribed me with his daughter, unquote. Due to this final act of defiance, Aurangzeb ordered Sambhaji to be ripped apart at the joints and then beheaded with an axe. Aurangzeb probably hoped that the death of Sambhaji would end any form of resistance put up by the Marathas. In the past, the death of the leader always signified the end of fighting, but Aurangzeb miscalculated severely. The gruesome killing of their leader inspired peasants and nobles alike to rise together in a truly national display of resistance to a conqueror. Colonel Anil Athal says as much, writing, quote, "The fight against the Mughals was truly a people's war," unquote. Thus began several decades of rebellion, which would eventually topple the Mughal Empire. The Mughal army was no longer a reliable fighting force. Instead of relying on strategy and tactics, Mughal generals usually used bribery to achieve victory. The Marathas caught wind of this strategy, so they began selling their own forts to the enemy, only to reconquer them in a short time. Aurangzeb refused to give up his dreams of conquest and conversion. He continued pouring resources and men into the meat grinder. It is estimated his army lost at least 1 million men during these campaigns. This says nothing of the 4 million civilians who died as a result of disease, famine, and atrocities, while the quote-unquote leaders at the top fought for jewels, power, and religious supremacy. These casualty figures are absolutely astronomical, and it certainly speaks to the vastness of the Indian subcontinent, as well as its huge population. Taking up the mantle of leadership, Sambhaji's imprisoned brother, Rajaram, became the new Chhatrapati, or Lord Protector, of the Marathas, for the second time. He fought vigorously against the Mughal menace until his death in 1700. His wife, Tarabai, would continue the struggle into the 18th century and become a revered figure in her native land of Maharashtra. She would remain the ad hoc leader of the Marathas until her son, Sahu, came of age in 1714 and founded the Maratha Empire, which would become the preeminent native Indian power up until the rise of the British East India Company. Aurangzeb refused to die. The years dragged on until Aurangzeb was in his 80s. His sons were old men with children of their own who were all fully grown. The state's treasury was sucked dry. Northern India was now a land of disrepute, where corruption amongst the Mansabdars was the norm. The state Aurangzeb had attempted to expand and build up so desperately was falling apart because of his own actions. He had nothing to show for his years of campaigning except for destitute subjects and economic stagnation. In his last months, he despaired about the empire he knew he had set on the road to ruin. He prayed for forgiveness, but his many sins followed him around and nagged at him incessantly. When the end was near, he turned to his son and said, quote, "I brought nothing with me, and am carrying away with me the fruits of my sins. I know what punishment will fall on me." Unquote. Aurangzeb finally died on March 3, 1707. It's undeniable that he was a devout Muslim, who endeavored to rule based on the precepts of his religion. He was entirely successful in this regard, even being named a Zindapur, or a living saint. In doing so, however, he alienated the vast majority of the people he ruled who were not fundamentalist Sunni Muslims. Never before had a Mughal ruler gone to such extremes. Most of them sought to rule with a touch of tolerance, especially when it came to the many different religious subjects they governed. Aurangzeb's policy of violence and destruction turned so many people against him who otherwise would likely not have cared if they were ruled by the Mughals. In summation, Aurangzeb's rule undoubtedly destroyed the Mughal state and left it in a total shambles. If the story of Aurangzeb proves anything, it's that violence, religious persecution, and oppression will never sway a determined population from resisting, and in most cases it will push people toward revolution and revenge much faster than otherwise. In the next and final episode of our Mughal Empire series, the fractured remnants of the Mughal state will stagger through the 18th century and be beset on all sides by new and powerful foes. To hear these stories, as well as the stories of the rise of the Sikh Empire, the decline of the Maratha Empire, the rise of the Company Raj, and the first Indian War of Independence, you'll have to tune in to the next episode of Turning Tides. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. I hope you all have a great day. If you like what you heard, one way you can support the show, which is absolutely free, is by leaving a review so some people can find Turning Tides a little better. Or, if you really liked it, please tell a friend who enjoys learning about history as well. Thank you again. Your support means everything to us.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, M-O-V-O-P-H-O-T-O. Thank you again.